Tomorrow is a big day for D. Rashawn Gilmore. Not too long ago, he founded an organization called Blackout to address the health and wellness needs of Black gay men in Kansas City, and one of his first projects was to do an assessment from within that community of what their own health and wellness needs even are. It may sound like a pretty basic first step, but from what I'm hearing, it really hasn't happened before. And tomorrow, he's going to share the findings with all of Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman here with D. Rashawn Gilmore to find out what he can tell us a day early. Hey, Rashawn, welcome back to KCUR.
Hey, Gina. Thank you for having me. I'm always delighted to be here with you.
So first off, what inspired this whole thing? Take me back to the beginning.
So it was born of necessity, as so many great things are. And in this case, it really related to the need to understand where we were as a community so that we can talk about how to move forward. So previously, as some of your audience may know, I project managed a CDC direct grant to the Kansas City Care Clinic, and that grant focused on HIV care and prevention for Black gay men and Latino men. Well, as we began to have some progress with that grant, we realized that we needed to do more once the grant ended. And so it was Dr. Jeanette Berkeley Patton at UMKC who said, we need to do a research study that is a comprehensive needs assessment. But the study became more than just about health outcomes. It became a galvanizing movement or galvanizing principle for Black LGBT men in Kansas City.
When you say you realized you needed to do more after the grant ended, can you be a little bit more specific?
Sure. So often what happens is we get these big grants at these agencies, and then before you know it, the grant is over, and then the community is left with nothing. And so we kind of go back to ground zero, if you will. All of the momentum that has been built up, all of the progress that has been made, it's hard to sustain. And so for us, we had to look at how do we begin to take leadership for ourselves. I often talk about a leadership sort of, you know, black hole, if you will, where you have those who have the capacity to lead, but often don't have the desire. And then those who have the desire, but don't have the capacity. And so we were trying to really fill that void with this project.
So what are the issues, though, that you thought were going to go unaddressed if the grant just evaporated and everyone went back about their business?
Well, certainly, you know, HIV ranks very highly up there, but we wanted to do something that viewed our lives as beyond and bigger than just HIV. Like, that can't be the only descriptor that people comes to mind for people when they think about Black, queer, same gender loving men. So we asked the community, and we assembled a 21-member community advisory board. They changed their names to a community action board. And they identified 7 core areas that became the nucleus of the research that we did.
Okay, so tell me about the study. How did you go about it? It sounds like a group of people came up with 7 areas to start exploring. How did you do it?
So step number one was to find people who were either passionate about making change in Kansas City and making things better for the Black LGBT community, specifically queer men of color, or we had to do a little bit of negotiating with the powers that be, if you will, to make that happen. So essentially, we asked these young men to come together. They had been either part of grants that I had run, or they were relationships that were otherwise established in the community. And we got together and we held a 4-hour meeting to begin looking at what were the most important areas of need. And we not only identified those areas of need, but also came up with strategies to begin addressing those areas as well.
So take me back to that meeting and can you let me in on some of what came up?
Sure. It was March 2017, and we were in the conference room of the Kansas City Care Clinic, and it was a Saturday morning. We were joined by Dr. Natasha Adulaju Ajijola of UMKC School of Medicine Community Health Research Group, and she was going to be the principal investigator working under Dr. Berkeley Patton. And there was a lot of angst and frustration because we knew the issues were so immense, but there was also this sort of tone of resiliency that was sown throughout the meeting where people were like, we can do more, we will do more, we just need the opportunity to do more.
Can you tell me what the issues were that people felt so passionate about? You were saying that they're immense. What issues?
Well, number one, you know, crime and violence was a huge one. And so we had to really think about what that looked like. And I should say here that it would be a full year later in March of 2018 when a member of our group and a friend to so many of us was murdered in Midtown Kansas City, Rio Carson. So we knew crime and violence was a big one. Also substance use, mental health, HIV and sexual health.
What is particular about these issues in the community that you're talking about, the community of what you call Black queer identified men? And I'm going to talk to you about that terminology shortly.
Okay, sure. That's great. Well, I think, you know, the way to summarize that is the word disparity. There are huge gaps and the healthcare outcomes for not only Black queer men, but Black men generally, and their counterparts in the majority community. And so there had to be something that we could do to look at what those disparities were.
When you say health outcomes, what would be sort of the everyday terminology? I mean, health outcomes is such a, it's like
a
jargony thing, but like, what are you talking about? Health outcomes.
So the health outcomes, the way we define it, is the conditions in which we find ourselves relative to our health on a day-to-day basis. And to give you an example of that, we can talk about PrEP, which is a once-a-day pill that will, if you're HIV negative, it will keep you that way. We know the efficacy of it is plus greater than 90%. But nationally, we know that of the tens of thousands of prescriptions that were written last year, for example, only 9% of those were to Black gay men. Most of those went to white gay men who are cisgender, probably affluent, and have insurance.
So how does that interact with the study that you're doing? I mean, what does asking questions specifically of men in the Black community, in the LGBTQIA, obviously not L, community, how does asking that question of this specific population give you a new kind of information if you already know that, for example?
Well, it's twofold, because we can look at the fact that in Kansas City, we know that some 88% of men have heard of PrEP, but only 11.5% of these men are actually on PrEP. And so by being able to document that, we can then go back to funders, policymakers, program developers, agency heads, and say, these are things that we're seeing right here in our own community. It's not abstract. It's not the big national picture. It's what does Kansas City look like right here and right now? And it really becomes a call to action, or in some cases, a call for some people who've been talking about the action but not doing the action to step aside or step down because they're going to get called out.
So why hasn't something like this happened before, speaking of getting called out, I guess?
For a few reasons, Gina. And I think that, you know, part of what happens is that the millions of dollars that flow into this city, particularly for HIV education and prevention, that's just one example of it, for Black, queer, same gender loving men, it doesn't go to any Black led agency, group, organization. And part of that is because there until now wasn't one. And prior to that, it was okay for these organizations to get the money because they had been established in the community. They were trusted by the funders, including the CDC. And so it was easy for them to say, oh, we've got these connections and we can do it. But until you begin to empower a community, you're not really going to see systemic and sustainable change.
How many Black queer identifying men do you think there are in Kansas City?
Great question. Well, we had to identify a sample size. And so to identify a sample size, we've got to look at what do we believe the population is. And so we use a range of metrics and prior data to look at that. So we approximated that there were anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000. And that's a big number, I know. But we took a small percentage of those and looked at what do they think is going on in Kansas City.
How many people did participate in the survey?
So we had a goal of 200, and we exceeded that goal by 114. So we had 314 people interact with us on some level with the survey, with the assessment. And of that 314, a good number of them did not qualify because one of the questions that we asked was, have you been sexually active in the past 12 months? And much to our surprise, one of our learnings was the fact that many people had not. So those who completed the entire survey, 227, and I should tell your audience, it was not a 5 or 10 question survey. It was extensive and it took up to 45 minutes to complete.
Wow. So what else did you learn that kind of surprised you? I know you're going to be probably speaking a little bit vaguely here because your big reveal is tomorrow, but do you have any sort of broad realizations that are new to you? I mean, you're a member of the community you're talking
Sure.
about. And so I think it's an interesting position to be in, to be part of a community and also trying to learn more about that community.
It is so challenging. And you're the first person to ever really, you know, sort of spoke to that because and it is kind of a dichotomy. When you work at these larger agencies and you're trying to be an advocate for your community within the agency, and then you have to turn around and do that within the community, it is very, very, very difficult. But it also puts me in a seat of knowledge and one of humility, too. I recognize that I'm here to serve my community, so I'm never, ever apologetic about what I have to say and what I have to do or in advocating for my community, because we know what's best for us and we know who's got our best interest at heart.
Tell me a little bit about the terminology you use, because queer identified and also same gender loving, they both seem very deliberate.
They are. And I, like many Black people, the word, you know, who are LGBT or not, the term queer used to be extremely offensive, and for many people it still is. And if you look at the definition of that word, it does mean sort of misfit or weird, and some were able to appropriate that unto the struggle and unto ourselves, but many of us did not like that. Part of what happened with the language is that the CDC uses a term called MSM, men who have sex with men. And they did that because some men didn't identify as gay or bi, but they were having sex with men. They were heterosexual. Well, that really begins to focus on just our behavior, sexual behavior, and not who we are as people. So the term same gender loving came out of Atlanta, Georgia, and I don't remember who originated it, but it spoke to who we are as individuals, how we interact and love one another. And for us, it's more reflective of who we are as a community, I believe.
It seems important to you, and we've talked about this some, but I want you to address it a little bit more, that this survey was designed and administered by Black queer identifying men and not just dispersed among you.
And that would have been the easy route. It would have been infinitely easier, certainly a much quicker process, if we had just developed the survey working with the researchers and put it out there and said, hey, take this, you know, the survey is going to help the community. We had the complete opposite approach. Again, because we were working with the community health research group at UMKC School of Medicine, their process is to engage the community through and through. So our guys came up with the 7 core areas. They also identified other issues that were not part of the core areas, but which ran through that, like racial bias, like stigma, religiosity, those kinds of things that came into play. But the guys came up with 166 different strategies across the 7 core areas of interest. And they owned every bit. When I'm telling you, they terminology, punctuation, they were on it.
Can you, I mean, I just think about communities that I'm a part of, and if you got a handful of us together and said, what are the issues that mean the most to you? What is the language you would like to speak to you? I'm not sure that you would find, even with a sample size of like 5, that you would get consensus on everything. Were there any issues where even just identifying what matters to us, what language do we want? Were there areas where even with your core group, there was dissent and disagreement and tension?
Are you asking if we got a room full of 20 plus gay men if there were catfights? Absolutely.
Well, that was not the way I was thinking of it.
Absolutely. I mean, there were a lot of contentious conversations, but I viewed that as healthy. I viewed it as necessary and ultimately as productive.
But can you give me an example? And I'm not asking this to be like salacious or sensationalizing, but just to acknowledge that, like, that even you're talking about the importance of the community developing its own questions and its own needs to be the ones to say, this is what we need. But as an outsider, I am curious about just that process and what issues do come up that I wouldn't know about.
Well, I think one of the areas that was a major point of contention was around representation and why there are not other marginalized LGBT folk of color in the room. For example, our trans brothers and sisters. For example, our Latinx brothers and sisters. But I was very adamant about the fact that I do not want to try to represent groups that I am not a part of. I will give my last to help educate others on what we've done. I'll show them how we did every single thing, but it was important to us and ultimately led to a lot of arguments, frankly, about our disagreements. I shouldn't say arguments, disagreements about why we should do it this way. But ultimately, we felt that that was in the best interest of the entire community to make sure that we were being true to who we were and that we will help other people to stand up for themselves as well.
So did the novel approach give you access to information that hadn't really surfaced before, even like on your radar as someone who's totally dedicated to this issue?
Unquestionably. I mean, some of the things that we looked at, for example, the number of people who had experienced an unwanted sexual encounter before the age of 17, it was just mind-blowing. the adverse childhood experiences scale, if you will, the number of people who had experienced traumatic life events that have impacted them from childhood to today in adulthood was sort of mind-blowing as well. You know, one of the things that we really were sort of just shocked by was racial bias. And not because it was just so over the top or so unexpected, but one of the things that we found is that so many of our guys didn't even realize when they had experienced racial bias because it had just become a normal course of experiencing life in this city or in this country. And so that was really shocking for us. But it goes without saying that the two places people felt the most discrimination or the two times were when they were interacting with the police and usually as a result of their race, and then when they were at a church or in a religious setting because of their sexuality.
What about the like a medical setting? I would think that in a study that's ultimately trying to address health needs, that the medical setting would be the one you talk about most, but maybe that's not.
So we did ask, and we asked very specifically, how is the care that you're receiving at Truman, at the Kansas City Care Clinic, at the Good Samaritan Project, and all these other places? We wanted to know, and the community told us. And so we're going to be going back to these organizations and saying, here's what's happening. One particular organization has about 30% of the population going there for primary care. But they also experience a great degree of discomfort or discrimination when they enter those doors. And so that's a huge problem we've got to begin to address. And so we're going to find out who's serious about these so-called diversity and inclusion and cultural competency, cultural humility efforts, and who's not.
I want to talk to David Bridgeforth Jr. He's coming from New York City to Kansas City tomorrow for the big unveiling of the survey results. He's the publisher of DBQ magazine. He's an activist in issues surrounding HIV and an advocate for the LGBTQIA community on the national level. And David, you know, you've been listening to D. Rashawn Gilmore talking about the challenges in Kansas City.
Yeah.
Is this part of a national story?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The same issues that he's speaking of show up in Harlem, show up in Indianapolis, Indiana, where I'm from, show up in Atlanta, Georgia, where I'm doing new work in the community. These issues are very prominent amongst our community, no matter where you find yourself.
What would you say? It seems like there's a level of complexity to addressing health within the Black queer identified community, as we're in the terminology we're using. What is complex about this?
Well, it's complex because our community is experiencing something that many times the rest of the world can't really relate to. I mean, imagine being LGBTQ and never being celebrated for that. Heterosexual people have always been celebrated for their sexuality. They've always been affirmed in the community, in the world, you know. And so imagining the opposite of that, and just now our culture is beginning to accept and celebrate in a small way our community. But with that segregation, with that comes a lot of mental health issues, comes the stigmas, comes all the stuff that we deal with that people, it's hard for them to understand, but it's all related to how our community has been surviving these years.
Are there communities where they've done things that we should be looking to maybe emulate here, or are we in some ways on the cutting edge with this survey?
Well, the survey is. That's why I'm so excited to come to Kansas City, because, you know, what they're doing to Blackout is amazing. I think that we should be duplicating this approach with our people and our community coming together to create solutions.
What is amazing about it to you?
I think that his courage to do the work, his courage to, as he was talking about how he decided to do the survey, that stuff is what we need. People are not doing that. They're trying to, but they're getting it wrong.
Getting it wrong how?
Not having the right kind of people in the room thinking and working for the solution, not having people represented in the community show up. Many times, you know, we have other people outside of the community trying to find solutions for our community. Another great example, which is completely opposite, is this TV show Pose that is on TV that has so much celebration. Well, it's celebrated because Black LGBTQ people from the ballroom scene put it together. They're in the rooms creating a story. They are casted in the show. You know, they're all through it all, and that's what makes it meaningful for the community and a big success for television. But same kind of approach of having the people from the community come together to find the solutions is what he's doing, and it's something that should be duplicated in every city, in every program.
Do you have questions for Rashawn?
Oh, I have a lot. I can't wait. I have so many. I can't wait to see him.
Just one.
Just one right now?
Yeah.
I would like to know where the passion and the courage comes from to do all of this stuff. Because this work is not easy work to do at all. You know, but which is why people don't really want to invest the time and energy to do anything in the community. It's a lot of work to do. You speak of the complexities that we experience. Well, imagine being a part of the community, facing them on a personal level, and then professionally spending your time and energy to trying to find solutions for our community.
Let me just first say, David, I'm going to get you for that one because that's a tough question, but it's a good one. You know, and I'm finding myself emotional right now, surprisingly. It is tough. It has not been easy. And approaching this work has come at great personal sacrifice for me. And I don't mean to make myself any sort of martyr. But there comes a point in your life when if you're in a position to lead, then you must. And while certainly new leadership can arise, who knows how long it could be before that happens and how people suffer irreversibly often until that new leadership does surface. So I found myself in this position, and I posted a tweet or I posted a meme recently that said, I'll get it done, but I'll do it kicking, screaming, and cussing the entire way. But I believe in this community, and I know that we can do greater things if we're given the opportunity.
Well, our time is up, but I'm going to look forward to following up with you as this whole thing progresses. DeRashawn Gilmore, thank you.
Thank you so much, Gina, and thank you to the Healthcare Foundation for funding this study.
DeRashawn Gilmore is the founder and president of Blackout, serving Black queer-identified men in Kansas City, and we just spoke with David Bridgeforth, who's coming in from New York City for tomorrow's unveiling of new data on the health needs of that community. That event is at the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation at 11. I'm Gina Kauffman. Up next, women's baseball. We are back. I'm Gina Kauffman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now women and girls are playing baseball as more than just outliers. It's a pretty big movement. In fact, the Women's Baseball World Cup, an international tournament, is coming to the U.S. for the first time, and an Olathe native made the national team. We're going to start our conversation about women and girls in baseball by hearing her story. Alex Hugo is with us by phone from Bethlehem, Georgia. Alex, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Congratulations on making this team.
Thank you so much.
If I played baseball, would I have already known about the Women's Baseball World Cup, or is this something that you yourself had to kind of find out about?
Yeah, I kind of stumbled upon it. Actually, one of the girls that I played in the professional softball league with, she told me about it, and I had no idea that there was girls out there playing baseball at this level. So I kind of just found it out, I think, like in December.
So you were playing mostly softball. When did you start playing baseball?
The first time I actually played baseball was at the tryout for the national team.
Whoa, that is so wild. What made you go to the tryouts for a national baseball team? I mean, I understand that softball is similar, but still.
Yeah, I think that I was very interested in playing for something bigger than myself. So my country is very important to me, obviously. And so I wanted to kind of do something that route and maybe get away from softball for a little bit and kind of challenge myself to see, you know, what I could do with it, how it's going to be, what to kind of expect, you know.
What were the tryouts like for you? How did you prepare to go try out for a national baseball team having never played before?
Well, I had some of my, I give lessons, like hitting and infield lessons and stuff, and some of their brothers, they would pitch to me before the tryout, and because I've never gotten at-bats off of like a live arm overhand, and so kind of doing stuff like that, and I basically trained how I would for softball, just on a different scale, obviously with baseball and like the field and everything.
So what is the difference between baseball and softball?
The biggest difference is just the size of the field, honestly, and the fact that now the bases go from 60 feet to 90 feet, and then you're seeing pitches from 20 feet further back than on a softball field. So it's just kind of, it's different things, it's different tendencies of like leadoffs and all that. It's just, it's a little slower pace, but still at the same time, quick and exciting.
Being a woman who plays baseball now, I mean, is that something that feels like a big deal to you, or was it, did it feel like a natural next step?
I think both. I think for sure it was, it kind of comes natural to me because I have been playing ball for so long. But also it's like, I'm proud to be a part of this. And like I said, something for my country bigger than me. And I think that we can really grow the game for young girls and then not just be limited to softball. Maybe they want to play baseball. Maybe they want to play with the boys, you know, like let them be athletes instead of limited to female athletes.
Did you want to play baseball when you were a kid? Did that thought ever cross your mind?
Yeah. And then softball was very big in Olathe, and around Kansas City, of course. But so I just kind of was always stuck in softball. Not stuck. I mean, I enjoyed it, but some girls don't have the option to play softball. So they do play with the boys until, let's say, like high school or something. So it's kind of all about where you're from and maybe like how you were raised and maybe the school systems around you, you know?
Did you watch baseball as a fan?
Yeah, the Royals.
That's something that I think about. I mean, that's the sport that so many people are exposed to, whether they're girls or boys, and then that girls have traditionally not been invited to also play. I mean, that seems like that would be kind of hard. I am not super athletic, so I didn't experience that. But it seems like if you're athletic and you're watching this sport, you want to play.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a lot that you can relate to and like imitate growing up watching baseball players, whether they're boys or girls or whatever. Like I just kind of went out in the yard or at practice and was just doing things that I saw on TV. And that's kind of, I think, where a lot of the different skills that I have came from, like me just trying new things because I saw it in the MLB, you know what I mean?
Yeah. My niece, she lives in Pittsburgh, but she plays baseball on a boys team. She's the only girl on the team. And she just didn't want to play a different sport than the one she was watching, kind of like I was saying. But it doesn't seem like a big deal to her at all that she's the only girl on the team. Like, she was insistent on it. But now that she got over the hurdle of can I play and people agreeing that, yes, she could, like, she just, it's no big deal to her. The only thing that kind of bugs her is that the uniform is too big, but she just cinches it with the belt and moves on.
Yeah, that's awesome, though. I think that more girls should do that. I don't think that it should be restricted to, like, there needs to be a girls' baseball league and a boys' baseball league. I think that kids should just be able to play together, you know? I think even in maybe, like, to the high school level, then it can change, obviously, going into college. But I think kids should just be able to be athletic with the people that they're around. So I think that's really awesome.
What do you think would make baseball more of an inclusive sport? One that girls, I mean, there is kind of a movement for girls to be able to play, but I don't know if everyone has received that memo. How do you do that? How do you change the idea of who this sport is for?
I think that people in the softball world, kind of being vocal about it, and like not only going over to play, but just speaking out for young girl athletes that want to do something different. You know what I mean? I don't think it should be so restricted to, well, you're a girl, you play softball. I think people that have been through D1, D2, D3 programs playing softball or baseball should speak out and kind of like create a movement that way. And I know social media is huge. So I think it'll, if somebody gets the ball rolling on that, then people will join in whether they want to go play baseball or not, if that makes sense.
Yeah. What's been surprising to you as you've made this leap from softball, from professional softball into baseball?
I think it's just, I don't know. I think it's still natural to me, but I think it's kind of learning that I am in a new world almost, and kind of getting acclimated to how the game's played, like the norms of the game.
Can you give an example?
So like, let's say in softball, you can't lead off the base until the pitcher releases the ball, right? So baseball, obviously, you can get off early and then they can try to pick you off. So you're learning the tendencies of how far to get off and like what pitcher is going to pick you off. Whereas softball, you're just chilling on the base until they let go of the ball. You know what I mean? So now it's like you are almost relearning different strategies in all different aspects, and in that one in particular.
What do you know about the fans of women's baseball? I mean, this is the first time the Women's Baseball World Cup is coming to the U.S. Is there a fan base just ready to be a part of this and be there supporting you guys?
I'm very interested to see that as well, because I, like I said, I had known nothing, and I don't know, like, in the U.S. if there is a huge fan base. I know in on the East Coast, like North Carolina and all that, they have a lot more girls in baseball. So maybe that might trickle down into Florida, and they're going to see and taking their young kids to go watch the older girls play. You know what I mean? I think that softball is the same way. People might not be softball fans or like that particular school's fans, but the little kids want to go watch the big girls play, you know?
How old are you?
Just a good turnout.
How old are you? Just out of curiosity.
I'm 24.
Do you, as far as like getting ready to be a part of a national team in a sport, you know, you're 24 years old. This is like a really big deal. What are you doing right now to get ready for it? I mean, August 22nd is when it starts, right? That's right around the corner.
Yeah. Coming up quick. Yeah, like I said, it is hard being, you know, not getting paid for the sport that you play. And I know even like men in the minor leagues, they aren't getting paid as much, and a lot of their time's being taken up. How this is different is like we go to the tryout for a week, and then we kind of train together a little bit as a team, but then you basically don't see your team until the World Cup comes up, like a couple days before. So you're kind of on your own training.
So wait, I'm pretty surprised to hear you're not getting paid. You're on the national team.
Yeah, well, it's in softball and baseball. It's just there's not a lot of it's not a revenue acquiring sport, I guess, as a female athlete, if that makes sense.
It so if I unfortunately was playing football, does, but
yeah.
Can you talk a little more about how you deal with that? Because to train on the level that I assume you are training, how do you make that work if you're not getting paid?
Well, I'm lucky enough that my wife and I, we give lessons. We own our own hitting facility. And so we give lessons every day. And so I have a place to work out, and she will throw to me, do whatever I need to. And so I'm blessed in that aspect. I know some of my teammates on the national team, some of them are teachers, some of them have different jobs, and so they have to also work around that. So it's almost like a good thing, because it keeps you driven to the point where you balance what you need to do, and then also with work and everything, and kind of pushing yourself to get there. But I think it would be nice to solely focus on training, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be really driven to do this then. I mean, what drives you?
I personally want to achieve, like, my best self, I guess. And so it doesn't matter if I do awesome at this tournament or whatever. Like, I just want to be a good athlete as well as a good role model. So I kind of strive to better myself, and also maybe if I can change one kid's viewpoint on athletics and being a girl in athletics, then I think that that's kind of what keeps me going, because you can't really do it for the money, you know?
Yeah, especially if there isn't any. Thank you, Alex.
No, thank you so much.
I've been talking with Alex Hugo, an Olathe native who is on the U.S. National Women's Baseball Team. She's headed to the Women's World Cup of Baseball, which is happening here in the U.S. for the first time later this month. Call 816-235-2888 if you have a story about gender in baseball. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll hear about a local movement to get girls involved in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we are talking about girls and women in baseball on KCUR's Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 if you have a story. Are you a woman who loved baseball as a girl? Do you have a daughter who loves baseball now? Tell us about those journeys and how people experience them here in Kansas City at 816-235-2888. We just talked to Alex Hugo. She's an Olathe native on the U.S. Women's National Baseball Team. Now I'd like to bring in Angel McGee. She's with the Kansas City's new MLB Urban Youth Academy at 18th and Vine, where they're starting an after-school program today. And Angel, you make all your baseball and softball programs open to girls and boys. Is that right?
That is correct.
What is the story behind that? Was it something you did a lot of talking about? Or?
Well, first of all, our main mission is to encourage and empower Kansas City's underserved youth ages 6 to 18 using baseball and softball to do so, and really wanting to give them the tools to be the leaders of tomorrow and leaders within their community. And so with that, pretty much there's no real limits that you can put on something when you're wanting to encourage everyone to come out and try it and experience it. So we make sure that whenever we do host anything at a baseball specific or a softball specific clinic or an event, there's no, you know, we don't say boys only, girls only. It's everyone is welcome.
And you actually go out of your way to say that, because I could imagine that people just assume.
Absolutely no. It's very much an assumption. We haven't really had to make that notice, so to speak, because anytime we've had a softball clinic, anytime we've had a baseball clinic, we do have both boys and girls show up, and there's no, you know, there's no difference. They jump right in, they get into the field, they do the activities, and everyone's good.
Has there been any pushback so far?
No, absolutely not. I think everyone is just really more so supporting us in our efforts of wanting to get baseball and softball back in this community and what we're doing. We haven't, you know, in that area specifically, we've been so welcoming. And I think it's known the moment that you get here to the academy.
Do you know the stories of any of the girls who have come to your programs?
We know a few of them, per se. We do have a lot of our kids come from non-traditional family homes. We have a lot of kids that some are in the foster care system. Some are, you know, have grandparents as guardians. Some just have regular guardians. So we literally have, you know, our demographic stretches all over.
So what do you think that baseball does give to a community? I mean, we're speaking today about girls in baseball, and that's a population mm-hmm. that hasn't traditionally been playing it. What does it give?
For us, I think it gives opportunity. You don't know what's out there unless you go out and try it. And so that's our biggest push right now is really just recruiting and getting people acclimated to the sport. Not being afraid to try something new because, you know, to be quite honest, if you haven't been exposed to something or a sport in this case, you're not going to be more inclined to try it because you don't know about it. And so our job is really to get out into the community and to talk more about it and to tell kids why we're here and hoping to gain their interest in trying something new.
Did you want to play baseball at any point when you were a kid?
You know, I played all other sports except for baseball and softball. I always loved the game of, you know, of watching baseball and watching softball. I just physically never played. And honestly, I attribute that to the exposure. I was never exposed to playing it. And so for me, it wasn't a sport that I, you know, readily, actively pursued. I loved watching it. And so to me, that brings it back home, knowing my personal experience with it, because I wasn't necessarily had a great deal of exposure to both sports.
You know, can I jump in? Because I'm curious, you were saying that you watched it, but you weren't exposed. What specifically was it that you weren't exposed to?
Just actually physically playing it. I liked watching TV. I watched it, but I didn't have anyone really around that played the sport. I didn't know anyone that played the sport that was really around me. Everyone else was, you know, you did what everyone else did, which was playing soccer, playing basketball, all the other sports around that. But it never, for me, it never, you know, it wasn't anything that at that time of my life, I didn't, you know, wasn't around anyone that played it. And so I kind of just went with the crowd and what everyone else was doing. But looking back, I would have loved to. So now in my journey and in my job, making a big effort to create that opportunity, to create that exposure, create that experience for boys and girls alike.
Do you think that you will take up baseball?
Personally?
Yeah.
I'm so wrapped up in the sport from the job side of it that I feel like I'm doing my due diligence now.
You said that girls and boys are showing up for your baseball and softball programs, and that it's important to you that they see themselves as athletes first. Can you talk more about that?
Well, we wanted to make sure that not only that they have an opportunity to be involved in something that we're doing here at the Academy, but that they leave with something that they didn't come with. So primarily, yes, we are preaching and, you know, and basically trying to support the sports side of it. However, we want to make sure that we're reaching their inner being and their character and giving them something to build off of while they are on the field. A lot of our kids, you know, they have never played this sport before. So for a lot of them, we are consistently building up their confidence while they are playing. And so it's twofold. It is basically, you know, supporting them and encouraging them on the field, but encouraging them with their confidence, with their self-esteem, that they can do it. And that's it definitely correlates with one another.
Well, if you have a story about being a girl in baseball, you still have a little time to call in with that at 816-235-2888. We've got Mary and Waldo with us now. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Gina. Thank you for having this show on. I think it's really important. My experience was with my daughter, actually. She was on a YMCA baseball team with her brother, and they were very young. And we had a great experience, except for every once in a while, kids on other teams would bring up the fact that there were girls on their team and think they could beat them.
How'd that go for
happened.
Them?
They always won. But once the kids got old enough, they started looking at other teams, and my daughter was only encouraged to do softball, which was heartbreaking for her because she wanted to be a baseball player just like the Royals teams. And it really felt like we had nowhere to turn and nowhere we could put her to kind of encourage her to play baseball.
At what age did this happen?
Well, let's see, she is 12 right now. So I would say it was a couple summers ago by the time she turned about 10.
So the glass ceiling for girls in baseball was at about 10 years old?
Absolutely. And, it was our friends and teammates' parents that suggested she play softball without even realizing that, you know, the other team was moving on to play on teams with each other. And she wasn't really encouraged to do that.
What is she playing now at 12? What did she do with that?
Piano. we kind of let go of baseball for a while, and my son isn't playing either, just because we felt like we didn't have anywhere we could put both of them.
Angel, is there a program for 12-year-olds that this girl could participate in?
So how we do at the Academy is we do an abundance of different programs and clinics from time to time. And really more so scheduling. And so right now we're actually in a transition period from the summer to the fall. And so we're confirming a lot of those programs and being able to offer all of our kids. And so the best way to keep up to date with that is visiting our website at mlb.com/KCUYA. But yes, there is something for everyone. So feel free to reach out as well to get kind of more one-on-one talking. But all in all, we're definitely building up the programming. This is still our first year, so we have a lot to learn, but we want to make sure that everything that we're rolling out is the way that we want to do it.
Well, Mary, thank you for that call, and it sounds like you'll be able to do some following up with at least the MLB Urban Youth Academy and see if there might be something for her if she wants to get back into it.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm glad they're here.
Thanks. We are actually hearing a lot about this particular age group. We have a tweet from Jenny who says, I played baseball with the boys until I was 13, third base and shortstop at that. It was awesome. Was disappointed that I had to switch to softball and always wanted to be the first woman professional baseball player. Can you talk to me more about this age group? Because it seems like what might be true for little kids is maybe not yet true for preteens.
Yes. Are you talking specifically with Urban Youth Academy?
Yeah, but also just overall with sports. Like, what happens with girls in sports at this age? Is it just baseball, or is this something bigger?
I think it just it really just comes down to each situation. I can't exactly speak on that overall, but I know from here at the Academy's point of view that if we do come across that situation, that we are equipped to steer them in the direction that they are wanting to go. If that is the baseball realm, then we're willing to make those accommodations and really get them that kind of that steering and that support to continue to allow them to follow that dream of theirs. We definitely want to make sure that any of our girls, specifically that come to the Academy, that they are welcome, they feel welcome, that they feel like that they can, you know, they can play both in that aspect. And so, you know, when it comes across for ours, we're definitely will be equipped to handle it.
Will you tell me more about your own journey in sports? Because I know you didn't play baseball, but you did play a lot of other sports. And yeah, I'm curious whether you felt your gender in that, and if so, how?
So I never really, I'll answer that first one. I never really felt my gender being specific in any of the sports that I played. I played soccer, volleyball, I ran track. Basketball was my main sport that I played. And to me, I felt, you know, I always felt like I had the same opportunities as the guys that they played on a different team. So for me, I think it was just more well-rounding. And honestly, the amount of effort and work ethic that I put into it is exactly what I got out of it. I love the fact of being a part of a team and feeling like I had, you know, that sisterhood with my teammates and all the sports that I played. So for me, focusing on the, you know, the gender side of it was never really crossed my mind. But that aspect of the sisterhood and the support system is something that we definitely encourage here at the Academy and want kids to, our girls to experience, and our boys as well, being a part of a team and feeling like they belong, you know, somewhere that's readily encouraging them and being a support to them.
As you watch these girls and boys playing on teams together, how do you feel like that? Do you feel like that's a different experience, or does sisterhood just translate into sister and brotherhood?
I think it translates. I think primarily we started off with our first Sandlot League this year, which was a co-ed youth t-ball league for ages 6 to 9 years old. And there were boys and girls playing on the same team. And for me, it was just, you know, another encouraging support system that they had. There was no boys versus girls. There was no, you know, why are girls playing on the boys? Why are boys playing with the girls? There was none of that. It was all simple, just we're all family. We're a team at the end of the day. And everyone encouraged their teammates, and it translated on the field. Everyone worked together and really just interacting and engaging with one another. The coaches were both men and women, so all around it provided just for a positive environment.
How you've talked a lot about that your big mission is to get out in the community and expose more kids to baseball as a sport that they can play, whoever they are. Can you talk to me more about how you do that?
Yes. So we, of course, our efforts are continuously expanding from day to day. But we first wanted to, you know, our demographic is the youth. And so with that, being very intentional on going into the schools, the local schools, the school district around us, the more that we're talking with teachers, the more that we're talking with local organizations, getting a lot of their connections and their contacts, being at community events, being at community affairs, attending luncheons, you name it, we are pretty much trying to do it and utilize as many connections as we possibly can.
Well, Angel, thank you so much for talking with me today. Angel is with us from the MLB Urban Youth Academy, and Alex Hugo spoke with us earlier. She's headed to the World Cup of Women's Baseball in Florida. So good luck to her, and thanks to her as well. Keep telling your girls' baseball stories on Twitter. We are at KCURCST, and we like pictures. Just saying. So that's a wrap for today's show. You can catch anything you might have missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have both of today's discussions ready for you by the end of the day. Tomorrow is a food show, and we're talking about sandwiches. The sandwich you love, the sandwich you desperately want but can't find. It is all fair game with the food critics tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Suzanne Hogan, Sylvia Maria Gross, and Coy Duggar. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.